now looking at an education session to give us some background on issues surrounding regulatory assets and liabilities. And as you've seen from the papers, there are some, particularly in North America, who've taken a very active interest in this issue, presumably anticipating the changes that might come to them in 2011 and beyond in adopting IFRS. So the purpose of this discussion is really to give you a little bit more knowledge and familiarity about some of the issues and to explore some of the, we say, opportunities that exist in the world of accounting for these assets and liabilities, or as some might think, expenses and income. So, Sebastian, if you would like to give us an introduction, and then we'll flood you with questions.
Good morning. In January 2008, the frequency of the request to consider whether regulated entities could officially recognize a liability on an asset as a result of trans regulation by regulators body or government. A project then was presented and approved in May 2008 meeting. However, since that meeting, the scientists are still in the process of gathering and collecting views on the issue in order to make a recommendation at next meeting in November. The purpose of this discussion is for staff to present the work in progress in its research in respect of the different rate regulations of existing practice, accounting standards, and financial reporting practices, alternative views under IFRS, and the primary assessment of the agenda criteria. So I'm not going to detail some of the documents, but just coming through, we identified three sorts of rate setting methodologies, the cost of service, and price cap regulation, and mixture of both. In terms of accounting standards, we are aware of two existing guidelines, the one in the US and the other in Canada. Maybe there are some other existing, we are not aware of. In terms of the literature in our interest and views,
gathered sufficient information that they can now make an analysis and a recommendation to us. Peter?
There's one point on the technical issue. I think what's been said in the paper is that there's a common view that if those assets and liabilities exist, they are not financial assets and liabilities. I would tend to disagree about that. So that's one thing maybe where we should look further into. Yeah, the other thing that I would be interested in is when I look at the general criteria, it seems to me, and it's also said in the letters that have been submitted to IFRIC from the US and Canada, that currently there is no diversity in practice, or do we have to further look into this? I'm sure I would be interested in, but does that know whether there is diversity in practice or is there no diversity in practice?
Can I just go back to the first point you raised? You know, it would be helpful for the staff if you could explain why you think these are financial assets and liabilities.
Well, if there is a right, and there might be some circumstances, depends on the not met the margin that were introduced by the regulation at all, irrespective of whether you are providing future service to customers. That might be the case in some jurisdictions. So I do not see why that would not meet the definition of financial assets. We might discuss whether a contract exists, but I would assume there is something like a contract. So I'm not saying that it is a financial asset or liability, but I would like staff to look into that again and not making the assumption that it is an intangible asset or, a non-financial liability.
So in that particular case, then it would depend on the nature of the regulation, the terms of the regulation as to whether it might, in some circumstances, be a financial asset or liability. Okay, thank you.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to compliment the staff because I know nothing about the utility industry, and I thought the paper was very well written and outlined the issues very appropriately. As far as if there's an asset or a liability, I think it all goes back to the conversation that we had before the break, too, to see if you have an implied asset, a non-contractual right. And that's something that I think we'll need to take up.
Building on that point, that's one of the thoughts I had when reading this was there might be an asset, and I guess I disagree with Gita that it would be financial. I think in some cases, and it does depend on the regulation, the right that I could see possibly was an implicit right to make a return. And that the difference between a regulated entity and a non-regulated entity is that if you're just in the market and you're out to make a profit, that you're on your own, whereas if you're regulated, somebody's helping you to make a return and to stay in business effectively. So I could see that possibly there is some sort of asset, which is the right actually to stay in business, and that is guaranteed by the regulator. So I'd like to see that explored a little bit more in the thinking.
Picking up what Ruth said, I think that very, very, very occasionally there are liabilities, because I have known situations where regulators have required companies to actually cut checks. Other than the situation where they have to cut a check, and the check has to be cut to people that are no longer their customers, I do not believe a regulatory liability ever exists. To the extent that a regulatory asset exists, I believe it's an intangible that wouldn't be recognised as self-generated intangible. I do not see any difference between the regulatory asset or regulatory liability arising and the situation where a competitor comes into the market or goes out of the market and allows you to increase or forces you to decrease your prices. It is exactly the same situation. This is just something that affects future prices. It is a pricing mechanism. Okay, it may be a statutory pricing mechanism, but it is just the pricing mechanism. It's to do with the amount that you can manage to charge in the market. This happens to be by statute. It could happen in all sorts of other ways. Competitive things. It is not an asset or a liability that has come into existence. It's not something that relates to a condition after the balance sheet date.
Yeah, can I ask you to consider the examples in Agenda Paper 5A, because this is one of the reasons why I wanted to test some people's thinking about this. In that particular circumstance, by law, the entity is not permitted to make a profit or a loss in supply of the service. They know every month precisely the volume that was sold, the price, the revenue they got from selling it, and the cost of providing it. And that difference is collectible from customers. Now, as a mechanism of collecting it, the regulator tells them to put it into the rates over the next 12 months. Now, in their case, it's 12 months. They've also said that in some parts of where they do business, and when it's hydro, not gas, it's 3 months. So it's a pretty short-term item. And it's recovered to Gita's point, to the dollar. Now, they say that, of course, the reason why they call it a regulatory item as opposed to a simple customer receivable or payable is because the regulator makes it some included in rates. They have enough information to actually bill it on the next bill. They know exactly how much each customer has used in the previous month, and they know the difference in price that they would need to use. So, I mean, this is part of, you know, this is one of the things that I think, you know, Gita saying, should we think about whether some of this is financial or not financial? What are the components of the things? Because I think people talk in general about regulatory assets and liabilities as much as if they are all the same thing. And I think you can identify some that might be assets and liabilities and some that clearly aren't. But I think one of the things that we're trying to do here is to you know, separate the strands of the string and say, is there something here that's different? And the question is there more work you want us to do in that area of thinking to try to clarify whether what we're trying to do is identify the characteristics that need to be there for something to qualify, as opposed to try to answer the question in sort of in a blanket way for everything.
When you asked me to consider the examples in paragraph 5A, I don't know whether you're asking me to consider again the examples in paragraph 5A, because obviously I have considered the examples in 5A. What I couldn't find in the example in 5A is the mechanism that allows them to charge a customer that has now left the country, which I think you would need for it to be an asset. And I know we're on a going concern basis, but if all your customers went, all you would be doing, if you had a complete turnover of your customers, say, even though it's going concern, all you would be doing is charging a particular price to the new customers. So I still don't think it's an asset that exists at the balance sheet date. And I would ask you in return to consider the example of a group which sets up a subsidiary, which is a purchasing subsidiary to buy a particular asset for it, a particular raw material. And in the constitution, that company builds something that says you will buy these assets in the best possible way in the market, you buy it raw material, you will sell it on to us in this way, and you will have this fixed return under your constitution as our subsidiary. Would you be putting assets and liabilities in for that as a regulatory asset as it arises from its constitution, because it's the same solution?
Just in terms of more information, there were a couple of things that I had that all the letters that have been received are from North America, so from Canada and the US. These industries or these organizations obviously exist throughout the world, and therefore, coming to Guido's question of diversity of practice, I think it might be useful to explore how other such entities actually account for these now, because they don't have the advantage or disadvantage, whichever way you want to see it, of having separate standards, a la FAS W1, to say how to account for it and how they currently actually do account under IFRS. So I think that that's actually quite an important issue to explore. And secondly, I think that you refer to the national standard set of paper that is in here, and interestingly, in paragraph 15 of that paper, it says very clearly that this paper suggests that the entity itself and its auditor are best positioned to determine whether an asset or liability exists, and the focus of the paper is actually on the issues around assuming an asset or a liability exists. How do you then account for it? And I think that in terms of your paper, what has been explored around the scope is actually, is there the scope of our project? Is it to say, is there an asset or a liability? Or is it purely to say, if someone deems that there is one, how do you account for it? And I think that should be teased out. I'm not saying which way it should be, but teased out to say that there are two distinct parts. Do we want to consider both of them, or do we only want to consider the assuming you have one? Because does it take the judgment out of it? Coming back to what are we setting, looking at principles or setting some rules around that. So those were two points that I had.
Well, in
really, In considering and looking at what issues we need to explore on debt, I think it is important to focus on the control concept on the asset side, as Ken said, particularly when customers can walk away, as well as looking at the probability of benefits. On the liability side, I wonder whether I didn't see any mention in here, or if I did, I missed it, on revenue recognition. Is there a revenue recognition issue to consider if you receive money which you think you're going to have to hand back? And lastly, I'm not quite sure to what extent staff have really done this, but in terms of the research, if I look at IFRIC 12, there's words in the background scope of IFRIC 12, which I'm a million miles away from the top of arrangement we're currently looking at, and my understanding is that during the lengthy deliberations on IFRIC 12, there were quite a few discussions around this type of issue and smoothing returns over a long period of time. So I think I've just asked staff to backtrack on all that thinking.
On rare occasions, I've seen regulatory assets and liabilities that really do look like receivables and payables to me, because the entity actually has been told by the regulator, this money is yours. We would like you to please collect it in the following way, but if that doesn't work, then you'll get it a different way. Usually it's not very specific as to what that way is, but I've seen those on rare occasions that sound like they could be financial assets and liabilities. Beyond that, I have trouble understanding how these kind of regulatory assets would fit under the framework. The right to charge more than you would normally be able to charge doesn't seem like an asset. All companies have that right that are not regulated. They do not recognize it as an intangible asset or a financial asset or any other kind of asset. It does seem to me that regulation could create liabilities by limiting your ability to charge as much as you might otherwise want to charge. I can see how one might think regulation creates a liability because you are prohibited from doing what you might otherwise be able to do in the market. So I find that easier to consider. A regulatory asset for the right to charge above costs, well, I don't see how that asset is any different from anybody else. The only thing you could argue is that in the case of the utility, the future business is guaranteed to be there because people have to use electricity. That sounds like a very strong customer relationship. And if we want to talk about whether we ought to recognize self-generated customer relationships, okay, I'm with Ken. I think that's something that we don't recognize currently, and I'm not sure we want to try to develop the model that allows us to do so.
An answer to Joanna, I think the problem exists in major utility industry in Europe, with maybe a difference that sometimes there's a part of the activity which is regulated and another which is not. I quite agree with Scott that in my view, in most, first, I don't see many cases where due to the in the local accounting system, they will register a regulatory asset or liability. In my view, the problem is more on the liability side, as Scott described, when there is a limit on the tariff that you may on the tariff increase you can make the following year. So it could be a create a liability and create indirectly a problem of revenue recognition in that type of situation.
I said earlier that I see a regulatory liability in the very rare case, which I have seen where the company has to cut a check to customers
including ex-customers. I can also see that the situation that Scott's raising about rates through liability, where the regulation forces the company to operate at a loss, but it would only be where they're operating at a loss. It would not extend to the situation where they operate at a lower profit than they otherwise would have been able to do without the regulation. So I accept Scott's argument for regulatory liability, but only where the contract, where the regulation actually forces them into an onerous position.
So, just to be clear, because I think that I'm concerned with an analysis that says I can't have an asset because I don't control it, but I do have a liability because somebody might make me give some of this back. It seems. No, but that's not what you guys said, but that's what I thought I was hearing from Lee said, that it seems to me that if you've got a control problem on the asset side, you've got a passive in problem on the liability side, unless there's something that's identified a specific amount of cash to be collected from a specifically identifiable counterparty, which I think is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, and equally on the liability side, if there's a specific, the regulator has imposed an obligation to pay a specifically identified amount of money to a specific party, and that is the case in the Hapland. Or if the regulator says, we are going to use our power as a regulator to force you to continue to operate, and we will force you to continue to operate at a loss, that you then are in some sort of onerous contract position. But those are the only situations.
I quite agree with that. Our difficulty is to figure out whether in a normal case you should have either an asset or a liability based on the regulation of rates. The argument saying that you have these regulated industries are allowed to charge above their cost is exactly the same for non-regulated. In many situations you are not allowed to charge under your cost. It's against the law. So I don't really see how you could have an asset in those circumstances.
Because it is an educational system, I would like to raise one point apart from accounting logic regarding this issue. We have to be careful that this kind of accounting standard is not just purely the accounting standard. It could be a part of political measure or political technique, because it could be a kind of combination of other regulations and accounting standards. And so if it is a local accounting standard, it is possible because it is based on one government or one regional policy. Then they can use it in combination with regulation and accounting standards. But now it's an international accounting standard, and the hundreds of countries are going to adopt international accounting standards. So we have to be very careful. If we decide one thing, it may affect policies of economic policies of countries or regions. So that's the other way around. So accounting standards may affect economic policy. So we have to be very careful about it, because it is educational session that I'm saying such kind of things, and that we have to start discussing this. Just one point I wanted to raise.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that this created a great deal of anxiety for certain regulated enterprise in North America, and I think that's a very important issue that we should try to tackle, essentially, whether there's an asset or not under IFRS. And I kind of don't like the approach to say, well, this is simply a cost-plus mechanism for the future. I think what we're talking about here is arrived from past events, the result of what happened during the year. At the end of the year, if you haven't made a certain return, for example, then you have a right to recover. This right to recover doesn't come from your relation with the customer. It comes from the regulation. It comes from a governmental power, and therefore I think it's a little bit arguing that it's simply, you know, a normal situation where you can simply charge a price, a higher price for future services is not the right analysis. For me, it has to be viewed in the context of the special situation where you have this regulation that is hanging there.
It's interesting listening to what John said. I think we are not recognizing a sensible liability for the regulation. If you would do so, then maybe you would remeasure this sensible liability in accordance with the new rates that can be charged to the customers in the future. I think what we recognize is maybe an intangible asset, kind of a license that allows me as a utility to work in this area. And if we would then, for instance, recognize asset because I have the right by the regulation agency to charge higher prices in the future, that seems to me that like valuing this license and taking into account that we will have the right to charge higher prices in the future. I don't think that we can do that under IS 38. When I read the papers from the commentators, it seems to me that they also didn't make the point of whether we have an asset or a liability. Most of the argument they brought forward is a little bit more. They didn't use the word, but if you read it between the lines, it's kind of matching revenues and costs. And I think that that's really the point that we should focus on. Do we have an asset under the framework? I totally agree with what Ken said before, that there might be very rare circumstances. One thing I've pointed out before, that might be a circumstance where I have a right to get cash or an obligation to pay cash, even if I would get out of business the next day. That might be an instance where I could recognize financial asset or liability. But in other circumstances, I'm a little bit struggling. And the last point that I would like to make is the is there diversity in practice right now? I didn't understand whether Jean-Louis said there is diversity, but when I read
diversity, as far as it, there is no asset or liability recognizing that. But if there could be problem if there is a different treatment in North America and Europe, that's true.
So there is an expected diversity in the future, starting from 2011 and maybe 2014.
I'm sorry, we have identified this as an issue because it came from the European Roundtable on Consistent Application. They were the ones, after all of their consultation, who told us there was diversity in practice in Europe. So, I mean, I can't guess better than they do. So that's Reinhardt, but that group is the one who sent us the letter in asserting that there's such diversity. We can go back and ask them if there still is.
Interestingly, if you read the Edison Electric Institute paper, they say current practice, and then they come say for entities adopting IFRS, well, previous accounting was allowed, so U.S. GAAP prepared to switch to IFRS because they were allowed. So, for the recognition of business and liabilities to regulatory actions, most, in brackets, if not all, entities have, in conjunction with their auditors, determined that the recognition of business and liabilities is required. So that seems to me that there is no diversity. But that's what we need to find out.
Well, when I had read through the papers, I had the initial reaction that Joanna did. It's a very North American-centric perspective. But in taking up what Tack had said, too, this might arise because of certain regulatory issues in particular countries. And as I was reading through this, I was wondering, prior to many countries moving to IFRS in the last couple of years, did they have any specialized accounting anyplace else covering this topic? We couldn't find any. We asked the standard setters that we know in countries that have moved. My guess is that if people were shifting, it was because of the migration of FAS-71 accounting worldwide. So, like, most of the standard setters didn't have their own standards, but by and large,
the regulated entities were either following regulatory accounting or thinking about 71 as a most GAAP hierarchies had that you can look at as a national standard setter. So I think that's the only, as far as we can tell, the only sort of official GAAP worldwide was 71. Other than us, and more recently, that piece in out of the UK that prohibited the recognition of regulatory liabilities as provision.
Well, most has been said already, but I think following Joanna's, Jean-Louis, and Tuck's points on the diversity and on the political issue here. And before, I didn't remember that it was a European roundtable issue, because I too thought it was a North American-centric issue. And well, that's what they wanted, but they're not allowed to do it.
They wanted to see if applying our hierarchy in ISA, it would be feasible to use 71. This is why they asked that, I guess.
Because I did, from my talks, I don't remember anyone telling me that this is an issue that diversity would arise. So people know how to deal with these issues now as high IFRS in Europe. So, and if maybe we, and that's the thing what Gilles said, if we change that, then we could hit diversity more than that helping people.
Asked Reinhardt to come in on this, not that he was instrumental in submitting the request from the European Roundtable, but he has been following its activities.
Yes, thank you, Bob. First of all, I'm of course disappointed that not everybody knows the submissions of the European Roundtable by heart.
I was just asking Sebastian. It was attached to the main paper, so you have seen it before.
Well, it was not 100% serious comment. But more seriously, on the issue of divergence, and I'm not sure I remember word by word what the submission said. I would expect it did not say that there is divergence in practice within the European Union. There are representatives on the round table from different industries, from the audit firms, from preparers, from the user side, and if I remember correctly, what basically people thought was that there are jurisdictions outside who treat certain things differently from what is done in the European Union. And the question was whether certain things should be possible in order to have a level playing field. That is my collection.
I'll actually prove I did my homework before coming here. I've actually got a copy of my papers or and the submission actually says at the bottom, in practice, there is still divergence of views with respect to the accounting treatment of regulatory liabilities, so not divergence in practice.
Listening to some of the discussion here, as well as people back in the States who have spent my year on this, to some extent, I think the argument for regulatory accounting is an argument that says because of the extent of regulation, GAAP financial statements are not the relevant ones. That we need to be able to present financial statements on a different basis of accounting that recognizes the effects of our extensive regulation. And I know that the FASB members who voted for FAS 71 don't think that that's what FAS 71 does, or at least didn't think that FAS 71 does. But my read of FAS 71 essentially says, for these kinds of industries, GAAP doesn't provide the relevant information, and therefore, here is a standard that provides more relevant information. That, I believe, is a more sensible way of making the argument for regulatory accounting to be reflected in financial statements, but I don't think that we ought to be thinking about, you know, let's create a niche within IFRS for these companies for whom the regular rules you know, don't give the information that the people who follow the industry think is useful. I think there's all kinds of ways for companies to present the non-GAAP information that they think is helpful in their industry, and I don't think we ought to be, you know, trying to change GAAP to reflect the fact that there are other kinds of measures that are considered relevant to understanding that particular industry.
To a certain extent, it's been covered by sort of looking at subtly worded submissions and things, but let me just give you direct experience in relation to diversity of writers. It's a very dangerous thing to say, delighted to have any clients that are recognizing these things, if somebody will pop one out in Pathfinder and Kidney or something. This has been an issue that has come to me and my group a number of times. People moved on to IFRS in every instance, except where you could actually see there was a specific check writable to specific people. We have said it's a pricing mechanism, that's the liability. That has caused squeals of pain. People saying they were talked to the firms, and my impression is that if they talked to the firms, they got the same answer from the other firms. I do believe that across the board, there is consistency of practice in IFRS. I think the reason it came up through the European Roundtable is there is a lot of happiness with that practice. A lot of people out there saying, we don't think that's what the standards should be saying. But I think that what we're seeing in this submission is, and it's not at all surprising, because it's only the same process that those people went through. A lot of people that have these assets liabilities that are realizing that they won't continue to have them under IFRS as it continues to be interpreted. So I don't think there's a diversity of practice. I think the reason the issue is there is because a lot of countries that currently recognize them are coming on. And that is the concern. Picking up tax point, which is, I think, is a very important one, I think that very much ties into what I'd said. It ties into what Scott just said, that there are lots of jurisdictions out there where these things have been recognized as part of a political regulatory regime. And it's the same sort of thing that you get with tax often. I think we've got to be quite careful how we handle those changes, because we could discourage some countries from going on to IFRS. But IFRS is a communicated set of accounts. It's meant to actually explain the true position of the fair representation position. So, you know, on that basis, I don't believe there is diversity of practice. I think that the practice is people looking at it, not liking the answer and wanting to link out to diversity. You know, I get to pick up something John said about this is to do with past events. That's why I made the point. What's going on? If during this financial year a competitor goes out of business, and let's say there's only four major companies in the business and one of them goes out of business, as a result of this year's events, I may be able to charge more next year. There's less competitors out there, I put my price up. Alternatively, if a new competitor comes in this year, I may be forced to put my price down next year. Doesn't mean I have a strong liability. It's event this year, the competitors are coming or going. But it doesn't give me a strong liability. Beyond an intangible that I have by operating a market with a relatively limited number of players in it.
Just a point. Before coming to a conclusion about diversity practice, maybe we should consider other sectors than utilities, because, for example, in healthcare, and you may have regulation on the level of tariff you can apply. So, and I don't know what they do. So maybe we should also look at this on this side.
Yeah, that could expose us to quite a broad project. Anything that is price controlled.
I think the staff has identified two systems and hybrids, and I think to Ruth's point, there's no, I don't think in anybody's view, a situation where assets and liabilities could possibly arise simply because of the non-rate. Now, there are a lot of jurisdictions where entities were rate regulated with rate of return and service costs combined, where they got pure rate regulation with no guarantee that anybody's ever going to make any money at those rates. limits and the rates are being pushed down. And I don't think anybody would ever argue that the existence of a price cap mechanism or a rate review mechanism creates assets and liabilities. It's back to the point, I think, that Ruth made, that, that the only thing that we think has any, I think, Sebastian, any hope of ever convincing anybody that it's an asset or a liability is where the rate mechanism is used to control the rate, the profit. It's got to be a mechanism for delivering a fixed or determinable rate of return back and forth to the investors. It can't simply be the fact that there's a rate mechanism. So it's that part of the reason why have we identified enough of the factors that we need to consider in terms of what characteristics of, let's get rate government regulation. You know, what are the minimum essential characteristics that could possibly create? And then let's have the debate. I think we need to take off the table right off the bat once they're pure rates. We vote. They have no hope, I don't think. Because that is exactly what everybody's saying. Everybody has the right to charge a price. Most of those guys that are rate regulated have a right to charge a lower price, just not a right to charge a higher price.
On those profit mechanisms, I come back to the fact that I think IFRS accounts are about communicating what has actually happened and the financial position. On those profit mechanisms, what happens is that they are allowed to make a certain level of profit in the year. They didn't quite make that level of profit, so they're allowed to make an extra bit of profit the next year to compensate, or they made a bit too much profit, therefore they're forced to make slightly less profit the next year to compensate. But they didn't make quite as much profit as they were allowed. Therefore, they are allowed to make a little more profit next year. So the account should not show them as though they made the profit that they were allowed to make. They should show them having made a little less profit.
How to do it if they have customers to buy their things.
Just a couple of thoughts. One, my IFCO standing committee, we haven't had a chance to talk about this issue yet, but we will have a meeting before the November IFRIC meeting, so if we can shed some more light from that discussion, we can bring it then or pass it along ahead of the meeting. Because we have 17 countries at the table, so there's a question about diversity and whatnot. Maybe we could get some feedback in that regard. Secondly, just now maybe speaking for myself, you know, when I looked at this question, whether you think about it as the revenue question or as the profit question, and just in thinking about trying to scope it, my question to myself was, what's different? And what I mean by that is you can have a lot of contracts where, you know, you charge the guy X, but if certain things happen in the future, you know, as the contract plays out in year two, you adjust the rates for experience in year one, either up or down. So the idea that you have a relationship with a customer over a period of time and that what you charge them in year one could then get fluctuated in subsequent years based on experience in year one is not unique to utilities. And so my question about what's different, I mean, are we taking on ebbing and flowing of revenue? That's a very broad question that exists outside of utilities, but then or outside of regulated environments. But then if you then narrow it to the profit, I mean, you have cost-plus contracts, so regular old companies can sign a cost-plus arrangement, which in some degree, you know, guarantees or whatever a certain rate of return that's eventually realized based on the experience of what's ultimately billed. And so, again, the thought was, are we taking on, you know, how to account for cost-plus, or is this issue trying to say, okay, with those economic phenomena, either the revenue adjustments or the profit adjustments via cost plus, are we trying to take on what's unique about the source of that mechanism being a government intervention, you know, versus the negotiation, the source of the mechanism just being the negotiation I have with a private counterparty? So it just seems like the root issue you can have outside of the source of it being a law, you can have it just through negotiation. So are we taking on the broad issue of how do you account for these things, or are we trying to pluck out, well, is there anything unique about the source being a law that tells you you should do anything different than what whatever the cost plus guy is, you know, is doing under IFRS today. And then the last point, you know, especially some of the letters from investors, it says it's darn useful to know, you know, from a projecting cash flow standpoint, either how much, regardless of your accountant's assessment of probabilities and all that, it's just darn useful to know how much you can bill in the future or how much you might have to give back in the future. I mean, I can certainly understand trying to estimate future cash flows, why that's useful, but that can be communicated through disclosure. It doesn't have to be. It's not ipso facto. It has to be via recognition and measurement. So there's other tools to, you know, communicate that information. So if the idea here is, what really is that rub is, if you don't have the assets liabilities on the balance sheet, the poor investor has no idea to know that there's big cash inflows or outflows coming. You know, another angle is to think about what disclosures might be warranted in this situation. That's it.
I guess we were looking at it is there anything unique as opposed to the processing? And I guess one of the arguments that I think people in the industry would make is that if you've got a cost-plus contract, you don't write off the cost when you have something in the contract that tells you you're going to be able to recover it. And effectively, their view is the regulator is acting as a counterparty on behalf of all of the customers and saying, if you incurred that cost and it was an okay cost, we're making the judgment, which is what the counterparty in a cost-plus contract would do. So that's a recoverable cost, you know, bill them to recover the cost in the future. And I think that some of that analogy is exactly what is, as you know, you see in the letters, they're basically saying the regulator is acting here on behalf of a bunch of customers who have essentially no market power themselves. And so I think that's a good point that we should probably discuss more in the paper for November.
But my only reaction then would be, you know, is the name of this issue, you know, accounting for cost plus contracts? In other words, would you take on a project to get an answer accounting for cost plus contracts by these types of entities, and what would differ? You know, there's just as much of an accounting issue under IFRS for a true counterparty cost. If there's an issue at all, I don't know that there is, but, you know, why would you sort of pick out, well, when the counterparty is this government guy negotiating on behalf? That's my point. What is it about that style of a counterparty that makes it a separate issue versus just maybe accounting for cost-plus contracts? And if you can't find it, then do you take it on? Or if you can find it, do you take it on broadly? Because, you know, it isn't, there's nothing unique. Other than, I think, maybe it was Ruth or somebody mentioned, you know, this, it's back to this, is there sort of some intangible, you know, because it's not a one-off contract, there's some sort of regulatory rights or obligation given. But that's a whole different, that's not a revenue accounting project. You know, that's a different accounting project.
I think the point I was trying to make is I don't think there's an issue about accounting for cost of contracts under IFRS. I think that if there is an issue with respect to this industry is that nobody is thinking about this in those terms. So if you wanted to say, okay, why should I get a different answer from cost plus accounting when the counterparty is the regulator as opposed to when the counterparty is. So to answer their question, we might not have to answer a question about how to do cost plus accounting if we say, this is no different from a cost plus contract, you know, go follow that.
That is your answer, sort of.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Just going back to that point, I mean, the point I was trying to make is that to me they're two completely separate things. There's the relationship with the regulator, which is where I think a right might exist, and there's a relationship with the customer where I absolutely agree that you don't control the customer behaviour, so I don't think there's a customer relationship necessarily to be recognised. So I think it's the relationship with the regulator that might create some special right or obligation. But just to go back to the point about the licence, I think any licence has an asset recognition problem if you're to argue that you can't recognise it because you can't control future customer behaviour, because a licence to operate gives you the right to operate, but you still have to get the customers. So I don't think that that's enough of an argument to say that you shouldn't recognise that special right, whatever it is, that the regulator might give you. You know, I'm not definitive as to whether or not there is an asset there, but I think it's worth exploring. It's certainly not the asset that the people who submitted the letters have identified. It's a completely different one.
I think we went all, IFRIC went in all these discussions, almost all the discussions when dealing with IFRIC 12, and we came to conclusions. Nobody is obliged to use a motorway, and the rates are based on projections, and there is certain sometimes a guarantee by the state that if the motorway is not enough used by the clients, by the motorists, they will give some money. I think all of this was discussed, and it seems difficult to me to believe we would come to different conclusions, essentially. Already been said, we come, if we analyze the problem as being the same, we are very close to saying, yes, well, by analogy, use IFRIC 12.
I partially agree with Gilbert, because I think that, looking at our experience, and I agree with the rules, when there is the regulation, there is some mechanism that becomes absolutely different from the free markets. I will not share to pay what I pay for gas if I have the possibility to have a free contractual agreement with the supplier. So I think, as I have no big chance to find other solution, and if you look at gas market, electricity and so on, it's not something that the customer could avoid to use quite so easily. And so I think that there are a utility activities for public interest. There is some regulators that has established rules. There is someone who has made investment. There is a law or something similar that prevents those entities to collect money enough to recover these amounts. And I think that one aspect quite difficult is to look at the assets, but this is a general consequence of the fact to look at the profits and the revenue recognition, because if it's uncertain to recognize or not an asset or liability, it's certain that we have to recognize revenues according to an accrual basis, and sometimes you will get more money, but you have to pay back this with a discount in a future period, and the contract is not easy to resolve in so short terms. So I agree with Tech and the discussion that was made before. We have to take a very caution and very prudent approach, because the item is quite relevant, and it's the element that could be touched are absolutely relevant and have to be looked at, considering that there is a specific sector. It's not a sector that can be looked looking at this by analogy.
I think that cost plus analysis is very interesting, and I think it's something that if we're going to take this off, we should look at. But if we're going to look at that, I think there's a significant distinction to be made in cost plus between a situation where an entity with some sort of contract, in some contract with a customer, on a cost-plus basis, and they say to the customer, we expect this to cost us 100, and we expect a margin of 20%, so your price, we expect to be 120, but it's cost-plus. And it turns out that it actually costs 110, and therefore they have a right to receive 22 rather than 20, and a right to receive that. Clearly an asset is receivable. I contrast that with the situation where the company says to the customer, we seek 20% return, we expect this to cost 100, therefore we think the price is 120, and we will charge you 120. And it turns out the asset costs 110, so they only make a profit of 10 rather than 20. And next time the customer comes along, or next time some other customer comes along, they say, well, actually, we made a bit of a loss on the previous one, so we've got something to catch up on because we want 20% return. Now, there's various reasons why the customer might agree to that. The customer might agree to it because it's still a good price. They have
good customer relationship. They may agree to it because the company has some sort of monopolistic power with or without regulation. They may be forced into agreeing with it because there is a monopoly there and it is regulated. Or they might be forced into it because the supplier already knows their business. They may be doing work on their property. They may know the wiring layout, various other things. And if they go to somebody else, they will actually end up paying even more, albeit that they're picking up some of the original cost. Those are all sorts of reasons why a company may manage to get cost plus between two situations where there is no direct contractual obligation for the customer to come to them and pay them on the second one. And I see why the regulation would be different from the others in that. But if we do go the cost plus one, I think we need to investigate that. And I said, I don't think the fact that you can do cost plus contracts have the right to receive the margin necessarily is the same answer for the other ones where you have no right to receive yourself to the customer afresh.
Looks to me, when I listen to the comments made, that most people are not agreeing with the fast service one gives you. However, fast service one is obviously a standard written by a national standard center for specific purposes. That's okay. I mean, national standard center can portray the picture he wants to. But what the companies to portray it. And Ken made the point earlier, you have business in taxes less time, and you have stock-based compensation as well, where the actually national accounting that might not be the one that we would issue. However, if you look at the discussion, I don't think that we really should go that route and may come to the same conclusion, because I think most people don't think that there is such a practice. The answer is pretty clear. And maybe that's because it came from the European Roundtable, maybe that's because some of the companies had tried US GAAP before and were not happy with the answers they got now, but that does not necessarily mean that the answers are not correct, because this is written. I think that the standard and IP is written in a specific environment. And for specific purposes. So that's not something that we really should incorporate.
All right. It wasn't the intention today to come up with what the solution was to all of these questions, but the staff is very appreciative of all the help you've given. they have a sense of your feeling on many of the issues. Of course, one of the roles that IFWC has is to interpret existing standards. Another role is to recommend to the board where financial reporting would be improved by filling in gaps where issues are not addressed currently in the standards, and even to the extent that the board would encourage and permit the IFWC to develop that material itself. However, we should be a little careful that we don't embark on a project of a similar complexity and duration as IFWC 12, so we need to keep a fairly narrow focus.
Chairman, just for old time's sake, given that Ian Wright is sitting over there, I think I should recommend the board pick this project up.
Well, what I'm going to suggest is that, not at this meeting, but when the staff feels it has all of the background information and the analysis complete, that it brings the issue to the IFWC to consider an agenda decision. And, of course, one of the courses of action that the IFWC can recommend is that it doesn't take it onto its own agenda, but that the board takes up the matter. So let's leave that for another day and perhaps try and entice Ian to come back and observe another meeting. Some of the points that have been made, all of them have been taken note of by Trish, but perhaps just to focus on a couple of things, it probably would be helpful to describe the nature of why the value of an industry that is regulated, regulated, why that value might change, the drivers that affect the value of the business as a whole, and in turn, therefore, to identify what types of assets, recognized and unrecognized, exist within those types of entity. Much would depend, of course, on the nature of the regulation. Trisha's identified two key aspects that she feels may give rise to the questions of whether or not there is a recognizable asset or liability that exists. And perhaps we need to be clear that there are characteristics. We can't look at 100 countries around the world and all of the different types of regulation that they have to determine in each specific case whether it meets our test or characteristics, but perhaps some defining principles and some clarity of which ones clearly do not and will not ever give rise to assets and liabilities under IFRS. Because we did in the service concessions project, and this is probably not a concern of the Europeans because they don't have to comply with it at the moment, but we did develop a thought that there was both an intangible asset model and a financial asset model that existed within there, and looked at some characteristics that are perhaps similar to rate-regulated industries, and often, in fact, service concessions are granted by government and the rates are regulated subsequently. So there is a logical interaction between that interpretation and what we're looking at here. And perhaps just to draw out some of the characteristics, as Gilbert observed, we shouldn't be coming up with different results now. So to the extent that we seem to have been allowing financial assets, not necessarily called IS39 financial assets, but existing within service concessions, then that would be a pointer to when assets might be recognized in this area as well. Revenue recognition seems to come up all of the time, and to consider that, but clearly it's not just the asset and the liability that we'd be concerned with, but whether or not revenue can be earned as received, or it can be anticipated because of future or because of present regulation that would give future cash flows to meet that, and of course the opposite. Trish, you have been taking copious notes to make sure that your new staff are going to be well directed on this. Is there anything else that you would like to observe or ask the IFRIC? Then I think this has been a good, useful discussion. I haven't kept you strictly to saying what other information should we present in the package, but allowed you to step over the edge and express some personal views on whether you think there are assets and liabilities and how they should be accounted for. But that's it's always interesting to get that view of where the future might be. Question of diversity, I suppose, just to confirm, is that if you're inside the IFRS world, it would appear from the comments that are coming around here that the IFRS world is quite clear and permits few, if any, regulatory assets and liabilities that would be recognized by those in North America who currently have national gaps that permit and require the recognition of these assets and liabilities. Because Reinhardt has pointed out that it's diversity in views of the desirability of presenting financial information that both the regulated industries and the panelists, as we've seen from quite a number of the comment letters written into us, whether they believe that that information would be more useful in making economic decisions, or whether in fact the information that they seek could be given as supplementary information by way of disclosure to the IFRS compliant financial statements. So I think we've given the staff more than enough work to do in between the meetings. So I'm happy to draw this meeting now formally to a close. Thank you everybody for your attendance. To remind you that the tentative agenda decisions, the revised wording will be issued to you on the Monday. If you'd like your confirmation or comments back as quickly as possible. And otherwise, we'll see you in 2 months' time. Thank you very much. Thank you.